Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're your shortcut to getting up to speed on the topics that really matter. And today, well, we're diving into something pretty significant. It's a piece of proposed legislation that could really shake up the digital asset world. We're looking at a discussion draft from the Senate Banking Committee. It's dated July 21, 2025, and it's focused squarely on digital asset market structure. Our goal here to unpack the key definitions, the new ways they're classifying things, and the regulatory setups proposed in this draft. We want to help you navigate this complex but honestly fascinating area. Okay, let's dig in. So first off, the bill really starts by laying down some foundational terms. When they talk about digital asset and distributed ledger here, what's the key takeaway? What are they trying to establish right from the start?
Well, yeah, the definitions are really important for setting the stage. A digital asset is defined as, a digital representation of value on a crypto-secured ledger. But the crucial part, I think, is what it excludes. Things that aren't commercially fungible, think unique digital collectibles, are out. Also out are things that just represent ownership of a non-digital thing. So it immediately tells you they're focusing on a specific kind of fungible token, not everything crypto.
Right, narrowing the scope. And distributed ledger is pretty much the standard definition, the shared crypto secured network tech.
Exactly, if it sets that baseline understanding.
And building on that, we get to what seems like the core concept, the ancillary asset. This is apparently a whole new category under the 33 Act. So how is this ancillary asset different from, say, a regular security? And what makes something not an ancillary asset?
This is where it gets interesting. An ancillary asset is meant to be this intangible, fungible thing, maybe like a utility token or a digital commodity that's offered alongside a security in an investment contract. But crucially, the bill lists disqualifiers. An ancillary asset cannot give you debt or equity rights. No liquidation rights, no entitlement to interest or dividends or any other kind of financial interest in the issuer. Basically, it shouldn't act like stock.
So they're really trying to carve out utility tokens from things that look more like traditional investments. Makes sense. Who's on the under these then? Who's the originator?
They define the ancillary asset originator. That's the person who first offers or distributes the asset or controls its distribution for the first year. And there's this interesting bit about joint and several consideration. If the main originator doesn't get the biggest chunk in year one, keeps people accountable. Oh, and they also define gratuitous distribution, giving assets away for basically nothing, broadly and fairly. Think airdrops. That gets specific treatment too.
Okay, got it. Now let's hit the really big part. How are these ancillary assets actually treated under securities law? This seems like the game changer. The bill flat out says an ancillary asset shall not be a security, and trading it isn't a securities transaction. That sounds huge. How far does that reach?
It's incredibly broad, yeah.
Yeah.
It basically says, forget what other laws might imply. This applies across the big ones, the 33 Act, the 34 Act, Investment Company Act, Advisors Act, even SEPA. And importantly, it also seems to preempt state laws that might try to treat these ancillary assets differently, specifically as something other than commodities. It's aiming for national consistency.
But okay, if they're not securities, how do you stop people from just, calling something an ancillary asset to avoid regulation? What's the check?
Great question. And the answer is this self-certification process they designed. An originator can file a written certification with the SEC, providing reasonable evidence that their asset doesn't have any of those disqualifying financial rights we talked about.
Okay, so they attest to it.
Right. And here's the powerful part, that certification automatically becomes effective in 60 days, unless the SEC objects.
Only 60 days.
And for the SEC to object, it's not easy. They have to give 10 days' notice, hold a hearing, and then the full commission has to vote to rebut it. And they need clear and convincing evidence that the asset does actually provide a disqualifying financial right.
Clear and convincing. That's a high standard.
It really is. It shifts the burden significantly, providing a clearer path for projects potentially.
So the message is ancillary assets aren't securities, but that doesn't mean they operate in the dark. There are still transparency rules. What kind of info do these originators have to disclose?
Right, exactly. Even without the security label, there are pretty robust disclosure requirements. Non-foreign originators have to file reports semi-annually. And the level of detail is, well, quite something. They need to talk about their experience, past projects, how they plan to promote the asset's use or value.
Okay, like a business plan.
Sort of, yeah. Plus details on key personnel, a summary of assets and liabilities if they're material, specific risk factors, not generic ones, but risks unique to that asset.
That sounds pretty comprehensive.
It is. They also need info on big owners, like 10% holders, management ownership, and deep details on the asset itself. How it works, its uses, fees, market, competitors, total supply, how it's created, governance.
Wow. They even want pricing data.
Yep. Average daily price, 12-month high-low from the top three exchanges. Info on external code audits, the underlying tech for distribution and trading, maybe even source code.
Source code, too.
If applicable, yeah. And steps for how someone could independently verify the transaction history. Plus, a statement from the CFO about being a going concern for the next year.
Okay, so it's like disclosure light, but still pretty heavy. They really want transparency.
It definitely seems that way. It's a tailored approach, demanding transparency relevant to digital assets, even if they aren't securities per se.
And can projects ever stop filing these disclosures? Is there an off-ramp?
Yes, there is. The requirements terminate 90 days after an originator certifies they haven't been doing much entrepreneurial or managerial stuff that primarily drives the asset's value for the past year. Basic admin doesn't count.
But the SEC can still challenge that.
They can, yes. Same process. Hearing clear and convincing evidence. But it does provide a potential exit ramp as projects decentralize over time.
All right, I'm moving on. The bill also sets up something called Regulation DA. This sounds like a specific pathway for these assets. What's the deal here?
Yeah, Regulation DA instructs the SEC to create new rules to basically facilitate certain ancillary asset transactions. And the timeline is quick. Proposed rules in 180 days, final rules within a year of the act passing.
And what's the main benefit? Is there an exemption?
There is, a pretty significant one. Offers or sales of these ancillary assets can be exempt from most of the Securities Act's registration requirements, though not anti-fraud rules like 12A2 and 17.
Okay, fraud protections remain.
Absolutely. The exemption applies if the total money raised doesn't exceed the greater of $75 million per year for up to 4 years.
$75 million a year? That's a decent runway.
It is, or 10% of the total outstanding ancillary assets, whichever is greater. So it provides a defined on-ramp for projects to raise capital and grow without immediate full registration.
Are there strings attached to using this exemption?
Oh, sure. There are conditions. The transaction has to be subject to those initial disclosures we just talked about. And there's this interesting bit about common control. If the network is kind of centrally controlled by related folks, the originator needs to take reasonable steps within 4 years to certify it's not under common control anymore.
Makes sense. Pushing towards decentralization.
Yeah, exactly. Also, the originator can't be like a shell company or an investment company, and they have to file a simple notice of reliance with the SEC beforehand. It's meant to balance innovation with some basic guardrails.
And just to clarify, the legal standing, these disclosures, while required, aren't treated as full registration statements for liability purposes, right?
Yeah, correct. They're considered a prospectus for some anti-fraud liability and a statement for general anti-fraud, but they don't trigger the stricter liability under Section 11 of the 33 Act that comes with formal registration. It's a different legal standard.
Okay, let's talk about the people involved. The bill has specific rules for related persons. Who exactly falls into that category? It seems quite broad.
It really is broad. It covers pretty much anyone closely involved with the originator now or in the last 180 days. Promoters, employees, consultants, advisors, vendors, founders, execs, directors.
The whole team, basically.
Pretty much. Plus anyone or any group holding 5% or more of the ancillary assets they got from the originator. It casts a wide net to capture potential insiders.
And what's this about common control rules?
The SEC is tasked with defining when a digital network is considered under common control by these related persons. They'll look at things like, can someone unilaterally change the rules? How is voting power distributed? Is the code open source? Who has economic or technical influence?
Got it. So what restrictions do these related persons face when selling their exempted ancillary assets?
This is key for market stability. Before the network is certified as not being under common control,
right,
a related person can sell, but only if disclosures are current, they've held the assets for at least 12 months, and the amount they sell in any 90-day period isn't more than 15% of what they originally got.
15% every 90 days. Okay.
And they have to report those sales publicly to the SEC within 5 business days.
And after the network is certified as not centrally controlled?
The rules loosen a bit.
Yeah.
Disclosure's still needed, still 12-month holding period, but they can sell up to 25% of their holdings in a 90-day window. Public reporting within 5 days is still required, but only for those who own 5% or more of the total outstanding assets.
So it's trying to prevent insiders from just dumping large amounts quickly, especially early on.
Exactly. It's about aligning their actions with the broader market health and preventing destabilizing sell-offs.
And if they break these rules?
There are consequences.
Yeah,
any profit they make from an illegal sale, selling too much, too soon, or without reporting can be recovered by the other holders of the ancillary asset.
So other token holders can sue them directly.
That's what it implies, yeah. A private right of action to disgorge those profits gives the rules some real teeth.
Okay, besides this whole ancillary asset framework, the bill tackles another huge issue, defining the term investment contract. This has been a gray area for ages, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. For decades, everyone's been relying on the Howey test from the Supreme Court back in 1946. This bill mandates the SEC to finally create a clear statutory rule defining it.
A codified definition that's potentially massive. What's the timeline?
The SEC has to adopt a final rule within 2 years of the act passing. And this definition would apply across several key securities laws.
And what does the bill say must be in this rule? What are the elements?
It lays out five specific criteria. One, an investment of money more than a tiny amount.
Mm.
Two, the investment is in a business entity. Three, an agreement, express or implied, where the issuer promises essential managerial efforts for the enterprise.
Essential efforts?
Right. Four, the investor reasonably expects profits based on that agreement and what the issuer says. And five, here's a key part. The profits have to come from post-sale and essential entrepreneurial or managerial efforts of the issuer or their agents. And it explicitly says purely administrative or technical activities don't count as essential efforts.
Interesting distinction. And what about commonality? Howey often involved pooling funds.
This is another big shift. The bill specifically states the rule will provide that an investment contract does not require commonality.
No commonality needed. What's that imply?
Well, it means you might not need that traditional pooling of funds in a single enterprise. It could potentially broaden the definition to capture arrangements where investors aren't necessarily directly linked financially, but are still relying on the issuer's essential efforts for profit. It's trying to modernize the concept for perhaps more decentralized structures, while still focusing tightly on that reliance on essential managerial efforts post-sale. It's quite nuanced.
Definitely seems like a major attempt to draw clearer lines for the digital age. So wrapping things up, let's think about the SEC's overall role and the bigger picture here. The bill reinforces that if an ancillary asset gets its value mainly from its utility on a network, that utility itself isn't a disqualifying financial interest. That seems important for true utility tokens.
Absolutely. It protects functional use cases. And it also respects past court decisions. If a court already definitively ruled something wasn't a security transaction, this bill doesn't try to undo that.
And the SEC keeps its power to grant exemptions, maybe even more flexibly now, using orders instead of just formal rules.
Yes, it preserves and possibly broadens that exemptive authority, allowing for case-by-case flexibility, which could be important in such a fast-moving space.
And the SEC has to consider things like innovation and competition when making rules and do cost-benefit analysis. Though, interestingly, the rules can't demand audited financials or expert opinions under this specific section.
Right. It puts some constraints on the rulemaking, perhaps aiming to keep the burden manageable, especially under this new ancillary asset framework. Overall, you look at this draft, and it's clearly a major effort to build a dedicated regulatory structure for digital assets. Rather than just forcing them into old boxes, is trying to balance encouraging innovation with crucial transparency and investor protection.
So let's recap the big pieces we've unpacked. There's this new ancillary asset category, distinct from securities if it meets certain criteria. There's the self-certification process to confirm that status. We've got detailed disclosure requirements for these assets, aiming for transparency. There's the Regulation DA, $75 million exemption, offering an on-ramp for projects. Plus, specific rules reining in related persons to prevent insider dumping. And finally, that potentially game-changing statutory definition of investment contract. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, the big question hanging over all of this is, can this framework actually keep up? It tries to draw these lines, separating utility from security, creating pathways. But digital assets evolve so quickly. As you think about this, consider, will this structure truly foster the innovation it aims for while effectively protecting people in such a dynamic, decentralizing market? Or will the market find new ways to operate that challenge these brand new boundaries, leading to, well, the next round of regulatory puzzles?
A lot to think about, for sure. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. It's a complex space where tech, finance, and law collide, and we encourage you to keep exploring and stay informed.